that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is increasing and that humans are the cause.
To be with us today. I'm Jeff Rolle from When People Lead. When People Lead is a podcast that focuses on people in their everyday lives doing something better for the world. And you guys qualify. So I ask our guests in every show, first of all, introduce yourselves, who you are, how do you feel, and what would you like to convey, or what would you like to get out of this meeting today? So I'll start with Art. Art Miller.
Hi, Jeff. I'm Dr. Art Miller of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography of the University of California, San Diego in La Jolla, California. I'm a climate scientist, oceanographer, and I also work with biologists to help them understand the marine ecosystem response to physical forcing. What I am happy to do is just to share stories of my life and how they relate to the questions that you're planning to answer.
And full disclosure, Art is my brother-in-law. And so, Ralph, how do you feel? And tell us who you are.
So, yeah, I'm Ralph Keeling. Like Art, I'm at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. I also work on topics related to climate. I guess in training, I'm more of a geochemist, although did a lot of physics. So I ended up in the field very close to my father. He was the pioneer measuring the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The curve, Keeling curve, is some of the audience may have heard of it. It's this rising curve of carbon dioxide. That's his curve that I have continued. I've also done measurements of similar compounds like oxygen in the atmosphere, all of this to try to track the big picture of what's happening with carbon dioxide and the human perturbation. How do I feel? I'm having a pretty good morning, I guess. It's unusually warm here in San Diego at the moment, almost freakish. So I'm a little bit hot at the moment, to be honest.
Okay. Well, we're not going to attribute that to anything at this point, other than the weather. So let's start with the history of the Keeling curve, Ralph. It's been going on for more than 50 years. It is something that science around the world has used as an indicator or as a trend in the atmospheric buildup of carbon dioxide. And why does carbon dioxide matter?
Well, carbon dioxide has special properties. It's a greenhouse gas. It's the most abundant non-condensable greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, water vapor also being a greenhouse gas, but its abundance is controlled by the climate system, whereas the carbon dioxide has been being controlled by external factors like human emissions. So it's got very important properties that affects the climate. And the Keeling curve was the achievement of my father's showing, in the early years anyway, this buildup. So it put the topic of modern climate change really to the public attention and to the attention of other scientists and paved the way for the establishment of a research agenda and a community that's focused on trying to understand this problem. And today I'd say its importance is partly symbolic, and you look at it and you say, okay, we still have a problem because it's still going up. But it's also relevant for understanding just how fast it's changing and what we could do about it. My hope would be that at some point with reductions in emissions, we'd see the curve start to bend. And so the curve could also at that point become a symbol, not just of warning we have a problem, but that we're starting to get control of it.
Yes. Art, how do you use that curve in connecting in connecting CO2 in the atmosphere, parts per million in the atmosphere, to the occurrence of more severe drought and flood and hurricanes, tornadoes, all of the other atmospheric weather-related issues that seem to be increasing as we go along?
That's a really good question, and it would require, you know, probably an hour or two of explanations, but I'll do it in a simple way. The Keeling curve is irrefutable evidence that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is increasing and that humans are the cause. The two reasons, or the reasons for each of those things are this, that Dave Keeling, Ralph's dad, basically was a very precise chemist, and his measurements are just, incontestable. And the fact that you're able to see this long-term trend in both, first of all, you see the seasonal cycle of carbon and then the continuing increase since the observations were started, modulated by natural climate phenomena like El Nino and things like that. That growth in CO2 is irrefutable. The other thing is that if you look at the ratio of isotopes of carbon that are in that those measurements, you note that the old carbon is increasingly becoming a larger fraction of that isotopic ratio. I believe that's called the Suess effect. And over time, you could see that it's the increase in CO2 is due to old carbon being taken out of the ground and put into the atmosphere, not new carbon that's being recycled. So it's not a natural phenomena where the Earth system is just generating different types of plants that change and then produce more carbon. So one of the key features of carbon dioxide is that it traps more heat than it would normally. In fact, if we didn't have carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, our temperature on the Earth would be much, much colder than it is now. So in this stable environment that we sort of inherited after the ice age, things are such that we have a nice, comfortable planet that gets cold in the winter and warm in the summer, and it's a hospitable place in many ways. But with the extra CO2 being put into the system, more heat is able to be trapped through radiative processes that, again, would take some time to fully explain. Because the air has more heat, the air is actually able to hold more moisture. So that helps to explain why you can expect what we call an enhanced hydrological cycle. The atmosphere is able to evaporate more and hold more moisture, say, for instance, taking moisture from the oceans and moving it over land and dumping it so it can rain more. But if the atmosphere happens to be dry in places over land, it can also absorb more heat from the land, so it can take away soil moisture and things like that, and also melt snow and things like that. So over time, you get an increase in the possibility for strong rainfall events, and also an increase in the probability of strong drought events for the very same reason. So that sort of ties back into your question of why CO2 is important. Changes in the variability of the atmosphere, of things like tornadoes and things like that, those things are still being studied, and I wouldn't be able to just say, oh yeah, for sure this is going to happen because of extra CO2. But there are changes in, we call it changes in variance, how much does the system wiggle, mm-hmm. right? There are certainly theoretical reasons and some observational reasons and some modeling results that support that you could have enhanced variance of things like storms, tornadoes, breakdowns in the polar vortex, things like that. But there's still, it's kind of dicey to say, oh yeah, that's definitely because of global warming, although it's, you could make some persuasive arguments in that direction.
Well, I think one of the things too is that first of all, I've never heard wiggle as a scientific term, but I'm really excited about that. But the other thing is that when you make predictions based on these things, and they're not necessarily direct correlations, it gives people who don't want to accept those changes room to wiggle in terms of their acceptance of those changes, because there's no definitive answer. And Ralph, how do you address that kind of Well, it kind of grows out of the scientific method where you challenge things. But how do you address those considerations in a way that can help increase the body of knowledge so that acceptance can occur rather than set up this polarization that we're feeling about climate change?
Well, yeah, thanks for the question. I mean, one point I'd make first off is that the polarization is pretty extreme, and it's to the point where mostly the people who don't want to think about this problem or don't think it's a problem don't even show up. Mm-hmm. So I actually haven't often been in a position that's confrontational, because the people who show up and listen are the people who are interested in learning about it. But as to the question of, you know, how do you make it persuasive? An important point is that the warming, the extraordinary warming we are experiencing now, and there's no doubt that we are in a period of extraordinary warming relative to the last thousands of years, really, really extraordinary warming. That was predicted based on very simple reasoning before it happened. We could see it coming. And so already in the 60s, there were pretty good, and even before that, 50s, in a way going all the way back to the Svante Arrhenius in about the 1890s, making a forecast of what might happen if we continued to burn fossil fuels. So it was almost, it looked inevitable then, and it happened. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that the theory was cooked up to explain the warming. The theory was there, and then it was confirmed by the warming. Incredible ability, you know, science achievement showing that this was going to unfold. So, I mean, that's one thing. You can also just appreciate just how weird the climate is today, just by looking around. Forests are dying in places they lived for thousands of years. They're expanding into the Arctic. There's bare ground that had ice on it for thousands and thousands of years. It's now being exposed by glacial melt. Sea levels rising at unprecedented levels. You know, this decade is warmer than the last decade, which was warmer than the decade before that, and so forth. When did we have that happen before? Mm-hmm. No time in human history that we can point to. We're in extraordinary times. So people just need to wake up that big things are happening, and we basically understand why.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can recall just in my lifetime, you know, the hole in the ozone with the CFC issues, acid rain, and those are, you know, more localized events, I guess, where people realized, oh, we're killing ourselves, and now we're doing it in a more dispersed way, I guess, is what I see. For the last 40 years, I've lived in a desert climate and a high desert environment, and I've watched the snowpack disappear. I've watched drought conditions continue rather than cycle and into wet and dry periods, where the dry period just keeps extending and the wet period shows up maybe once every 5 years or 10 years instead of every 3 years or 2 years. And it's created a lot of fights over water, a lot of fights over resources. You know, recent wars we've seen have been precipitated because crops have failed in some areas of the world, and people migrate to the cities and they look for the government to help, and the government can't help, so there's a revolution. The Earth is resilient, but the 8 billion or so humans on the Earth are not so much. And so what kinds of adaptations or what kinds of actions, I don't want to get into a prescription, but I want to say, what kinds of adaptations are we going to have to look forward to in order to adapt to where we are right now, the way the climate is moving? Art, I'll give you that. I'll throw that one to you.
Yeah, well, adaptation is not my strong suit, so I wouldn't know much about what
okay.
to say here. Obviously, when you think about sea level rise, you think about, well, don't build when you're really close to the sea level, because in 30 to 50 years, you know, it could be a meter higher in sea level. So, you know, strategizing and planning for the future is important. You know, this is being taken into account by many communities that live in coastal areas around the U.S. and around the world, in fact. Military facilities that are near sea level are having to deal with this, even though they're being told from above that they shouldn't have to worry about it, but they have to anyway. I'm just going to stop there because I think Ralph might have better answers to this type of a question.
Yeah, I'm really no expert on adaptation or its specifics either. What can I say? I mean, one thing to be aware of is sort of the long time scale with which this is playing out. It's playing out kind of over the time scale of human lifespans or even beyond. And many societies and people and individuals have a livelihood that depends on the landscape, depends on the relationship to rivers and sea, the adjacent ocean and so forth, that are now under threat. And it's very threshold. So you can cope until some point you can't cope anymore. One of the key things about this problem is that once you realize you can't cope anymore, it's likely to be getting worse faster than ever. So it's going to be very hard to decide what you actually do at that point. So right now there's resistance, you know, the New Orleans floods, and there's, okay, yeah, we're going to go back and build the ground and build it back again. That makes sense for a generation or two. But at some level, that city has to look different. And so there'll be a break point. And so all sorts of, I don't mean to pick on New Orleans, it's a wonderful city, but it's in a bad spot now. And it wouldn't have been if it hadn't been for climate change. And there are all sorts of things all over the world that are now in bad places, and not just cities, it's whole civilizations, it's people who are making their livelihood off the land. They reach a break point, and then suddenly the whole ground, it isn't just that they can move to higher ground, it's that the higher ground is going to be under threat too. So it's really a difficult problem. And the solution, among other things, is just to get control of the pace of change by reducing fossil fuel emissions. So I want to make that point. What do we need to do as a society, as a humanity as a whole? We need to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels so that we can bring the emissions down. How do you do that in a political context where energy is so important for well-being? It's not easy, but embrace the energy transition. Because renewables are fun and they're cheap. And so let's have a party with renewables. That's part of the answer.
And let's bring up New Orleans. I've heard that the Mississippi Delta region is losing about a football field a day in terms of land that's being encroached by seawater, by the Gulf, in that area. I'm asking for silver linings here. I'm looking for a way where we can move forward that allows us to enjoy this lifestyle that we have, but also become more responsive or restorative to what the resources of the world allow us to do. I recall during COVID when things were locked down. And they were shut in their houses. They were reducing everything that they did. But there were some benefits in the fact that the water in Venice cleared up. The water in Venice cleared up. Fish moved back in. There was a much better climate because there was not so many, because the emissions were done. Maybe it will take just a great reduction of our consumption to make our lives better in a way that people can accept, or in the case of COVID, it was imposed. So we had to do that. So are there ways where we can, embracing the renewable energy transition is a lot of what we're going to be talking about in this podcast. I have a background in some of that. And And I know a lot of other people who are working on that right now. There's very many different ways to do that. But there are also options to develop policies that can do that. I'm kind of vamping right this minute because I'm asking you to make policy for me. And I know that's not your function. but in terms of looking at the measurements, looking at the way the world is going, are there some things we can do that everyday people can embrace without constricting them or scaring them or making them worry? I fully believe that low-lying areas are going to need to address that issue. That's one thing. How do we adapt? Are there adaptable solutions that we can look at that people can start right now without creating a huge hiccup in the system? Art, do you know of any silver linings coming out of the studies that you're doing? Are there governments, are there people that are adapting things? I think there are some things going on in Europe right now that are exciting.
Right. I'm sort of thinking of a Northern European country, might be Denmark, that is like actually building new neighborhoods that are essentially floating, right? Maybe it's Holland, that basically when they, as sea level rises, a little, the neighborhood will just be lifted up and people will just live on essentially floating islands. So that's sort of one interesting possibility where a government has decided, you know, we're going to prepare for this in some sensible ways. But I think you kind of also answered your own question. Who do we want to have as a policymaker, right? That's the question that people have to ask themselves. Do you want to have policymakers that are trying to address the problem in constructive ways to really make life better for people? Or do you want to have politicians that stick their head in the ground and say, the problem doesn't exist. We're going to keep just doing business as usual, live the lifestyle that we lived 50, 70 years ago, driving our cars, doing whatever we want and not even thinking about it. So I think that's the thing that, you know, people have to elect representatives, senators, and governors and presidents who actually recognize the problem and are willing to set policy to do something positive for the society in the context of climate change. It's inevitable now. In fact, we're living the first part of the nightmare
right
now. So
how do you translate your research into action for people to take? Is it in the form of recommendations, white papers, whatever? Is it something that that you can, you know, there are conferences that share this information. There's the COP exercise that we go through where people present new ideas and new ways to go. Is that the only avenue that we can go, or are there more direct ways where what you guys do every day can be translated to actions that somebody on the street can do? Ralph, I'll ask you that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let me frame it this way. I mean, often when I give presentations, I show, it's a science. I'm a scientist, so I give a science talk. And the questions are what to do about it. So the people who show up get that there's a problem and they want to know what to do about it. But that puts me in a bind because that's not what I work on. I work on the problem. And as much as the problem needs solutions, it still needs people who are actually studying it and so that we get the trajectory right and we really don't over-prepare or under-prepare. So my own focus is on that part of this community. And I appreciate very much the question about what to do about it, but I need to start with a caveat that that's mostly not what I work on. And I'm not apologetic about it because society needs people like me. And here's the other rub is that people say, well, the bad news doesn't motivate. You know, we have to come up with good news. But I'm sorry. The news is grim. And I'm not going to put a silver lining on it just so that it can help policy forward. Our role as scientists is to be, just unfettered as much as we can, unfettered purveyors of knowledge and facts. And so if we stick to that mantra, our role is not to put silver linings on the science, it's just to convey the science. And I hate to say it, but we are in a bad place and we're moving into worse ground faster than ever. That's where we are right now. And as much as humanity has taken measures to reduce the problem, we haven't turned any major corner yet, except in attitudes of people. And that has to translate eventually into larger actions. And how do we get there? It's dicey because, different people are afraid of different things going forward. And climate change is not the only thing that scares people. People are scared about other things. And a lot of fear is a big motivator, and it certainly has been in the last
millennia.
Administration, the current administration. That's one of the big issues here. So another twist on this to put it in perspective, this is an international problem, right? So the U.S. is now, I think, less than 15% of global carbon dioxide emissions. We own a much bigger share of cumulative emissions in the sense that we've produced much more than 15% of the problem today, probably more like half. But we're not what's moving us into bad territory fast anymore. It's the rest of the world and us together. So the solutions have to be international if they're going to actually have teeth and get things done. So how the international community works together to recognize the problem and work on it is super important. And I guess what's happened in the last year or so under this administration is very discouraging from that standpoint, because we're disengaging with the kind of international conversations that are going to be essential for moving this forward. So that's really, what can individuals do? You can't do a hell of a lot. Individuals can't make a heck of a lot of difference without support at really the level of governments and international cooperation. Technology waves can come through and make a big difference. So that's the easiest ground is to say, okay, we have new technologies, let's go with that. And that's why I emphasize that, because that can be an individual choice as to what kind of car you drive and your lifestyle in relation to energy use. But that's not going to move the needle in other countries unless there's similar sentiments there. So it becomes an international conversation. And ultimately, the renewables should be empowering all over the world. People don't want to rely on petrostates for their well-being. So renewables provide a path to self-reliance and independence. So they're a source of freedom that
the world should embrace. But there have been many convocations, the COP20 whatever that we had recently in Brazil, where governments come together, they make predictions, they make pledges. They say we're going to reduce our CO2 levels by XYZ over the next 20, 30 years. Those pledges over time, when they're monitored, don't seem to amount to much. But there are small steps that are going on right now where, there's more things like balcony solar, for instance, urban areas where the electric grid is being consumed by other things, where they can put solar panels on their balconies and run their apartment on it. Some of the things going on from war that are coming out of Ukraine are looking at strategies that create that. So what I'm trying to drive is, we have the science telling us X, and so, like the people who come to your presentations, what should we do about it? And there's no simple direct answer to that, but renewables are definitely part of it. There were always the three things. There was conservation, renewables, and I forget what the other one was. Recycling. That's what it was, the three R's. So I'm looking forward to finding how we can A, get acceptance that this is happening, B, get pathways, get directions that people can take that they feel like they're making progress with, rather than compromising their lifestyle in order to meet some unreachable goal because nobody else is following me. Where is the hope? I know you're throwing the hopeless at me, and I'm trying to find the hope. Art, you want to give me some ideas?
Yes, we're living in a hopeless generation right now, but but you know, the thing, you can look to other countries and at least see that a lot of other countries are succeeding at you know, reducing their greenhouse gas emissions and switching more to renewable energies. I mean, China is now leading the way, from what I hear, in you know, solar, right? They're
mine a lot of
everything
coal,
they can,
but yeah,
to, yeah, stop things. Of course, they're still burning a lot of stuff too, but they're also, you know, leading the technological surge that we need, right? So there is hope by looking at even nefarious countries like China in terms of the fossil fuel burning, right? They're doing positive things more so than we are. So, you know, there's hope out there. There are some models, I think, for success. But whether or not we band together as a global community to address this problem is unclear because of, you know, selfishness of the individual, selfishness of the corporation, the ability of corporations to control people with false media, misleading reports and things like that. But, you know, Ralph and I are scientists, and sort of an analogy of a newspaper, you know, we're the reporters, right? We're just saying what's happening, and we can explain what's happening through a variety of things, through making the direct observations, through theory, and through running models to show how things actually are functioning. And we report that, right? Then there's sort of the editorial part of the newspaper analogy, right? You know, we don't necessarily write the editorials ourselves, but there are some people who are really strong advocates for changing behavior in our society. And, you know, we do that a little bit, like Ralph was pointing out, when people ask that question, we try to come up with positive news in a gloomy environment. But it's hard for us because that's not what we spend all our time doing. We don't, at least I don't, read every possible new technology and master the understanding of that stuff, right? But there are people out there who are doing that. And all of a sudden, you know, innovation hits and things change. We, you know, hopefully in the coming decades, you know, fusion will start working for energy, and we can switch that way. But of course, the whole infrastructure of that will probably take decades to build anyway. But the idea of, you know, using wind power and hydroelectric power and things like that, you know, that's important, as well as solar, right? So we need the infrastructure, and we need leaders to take us there.
Yeah, well, so and
let's work together to make them do that.
You are reporting, there's the real connection that you alluded to, Art, is that where